The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Frisch, Judge Ross, Judge Reyes, the Honorable Jennifer Frisch presiding.
Good morning, everyone. Can everyone hear me? I see a bunch of mute buttons on. I want to make sure everyone can hear.
Yes.
Wave if you can hear. Very good. All right. This is the Minnesota Court of Appeals, September 9, 2020. We are here for one case on the calendar today, and I'll have the marshal call the case.
This is A20-0437, Brandon Trenipole versus De La Salle High School.
All right, I'm going to ask all of you, I'm going to have a few announcements before we begin. The marshal will display the clock. Please pay attention to the amount of time that is remaining. Please mute your microphone if you are not speaking. Identify yourself and your client before you begin your argument. Each party will have 15 minutes for their oral argument. The appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. And with that, counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. Phil Villiam appearing on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Trenipole. This is an appeal of the district court dismissal of three counts of our complaint under Rule 1202. I'd like to first address the standard of review that is governing this matter. Dismissal under 1202 are disfavored by the courts. It is immaterial whether the appellant can prove the facts alleged. The motion should be denied if possible any evidence which might be provided consistent with pleader's theory to grant the relief demanded. The facts in our complaint are accepted as true. The court must construe all reasonable inferences in favor of the non-moving party. Complaints must be given liberal construction in favor of stating a claim for which relief may be granted. As the court is aware, Minnesota is a notice pleading state. It does not require specificity in the pleadings. However, in our complaint, we were very specific as to the facts that we have alleged.
Counsel, can I ask you, I saw reference in the complaint to a contract, a tuition contract. I saw a reference in the complaint to the student policy handbook. But what I'm looking for is the thing that was specifically promised, the service, the process, the procedure, the specifically promised thing that was not given.
Yes, Your Honor. In paragraph 19 and 20 of our complaint.
Okay.
Two dean of students, Mr. Lemon and Ms. Gilland, promised the appellant and his parents that he would receive and participate in the due process hearing. They further indicated who would be.
Where does it say that? I'm looking at paragraphs 19 and 20. Where does it say that?
Let me read it if I can, Your Honor. At the close of the meeting, Lemon explained that in his view, he thought that there had been a number of misunderstandings and that misinformation had spread potentially fueled by social media between students. Lemon went on to further indicate that the next step would be BT would participate in a due process hearing, which would consist of Lemon and Gillen, DLS principal Jim Benson, BT's mentor Kai Brinson, a student counselor at DLS, a teacher of BLT's choosing, and a teacher of Principal Benson's choosing. Paragraph 20 states, it was explained to Ms. Trepanol and BT that after that hearing, a recommendation would be made by the disciplinary board of review to administration regarding the matter.
So is it your position that the promise or the specific promise that was made came after the alleged threat that was made?
Yes. I mean, as the court is aware, the police investigated the so-called threat and they found no credible evidence for the threat.
Mr. Villiam, may I interrupt you with just a clarification? Sure. I thought your complaint was alleging, I believe I read it in your complaint, that there was a specific contract for promises derived from the code of conduct of the school and the policy of the school. It sounds like now you're saying that the breach of contract occurred based upon an oral representation that was made. Am I understanding you correctly as to the source of this alleged breach?
Sure. Yes, Your Honor. It's a combination of the two. We alleged that there was a breach of the educational contract, that the parents had signed and executed a tuition agreement and paid tuition full, that the appellant had been in classes from 2015 till February 28, 2017, when he was expelled.
No, I understand that. My question then goes to the specifics of the basis of your claim. Are you now saying that there is nothing in the code of conduct or the policies that provides the basis for the promise that was breached?
In the code of conduct, there is a promise for a due process hearing and a review by the disciplinary board of review. Furthermore, the school administrators promised him the hearing, and that hearing was denied.
When you say that it was in the code of conduct, you're saying that that's something we should infer from the complaint, or is that some specific promise that was included in the complaint itself? I'm just trying to get a sense of what is the source of the promise, and the source and the specific language of the promise.
Yeah, the language of the promise came from the two administrators who said, one, you get the hearing, and two, you get the review before the board.
So the language does not come from the code of conduct or the policies.
It's also, okay. I'm sorry, Your Honor. It's also in the code of conduct, and counsel can address that because it's in the handbook. And we take the position that the handbook, given the appellant these rights, are part of the contract, and that part of it was breached as well. Besides the promises.
But counsel, where in the, can you cite to any specific language in the handbook that talks about the process that a student is entitled to? Because all I saw from, I'm actually a little confused, because when I read the complaint and I read your brief, I understood that the allegation is that because he was entitled to an educational and the educational experience, that contract was breached. But now you're talking about, and I think what we're all trying to get at is, what are the specifics? Because under case law, there has to be some type of specifically promised educational service that had not been provided or had been that promise had been breached. And so I'm still not sure where it is, because, and I just want to focus on anything that's written. What in the code of conduct, where in the code of conduct does it say that a student is entitled to a certain type of due process?
Yeah, I don't think we quoted in our complaint the handbook or the code of conduct. I'm sure we didn't. But what we felt was most relevant in that regard was the representation on March 2nd, 2017 by the administrators. They said to the appellant, you get the due process hearing consistent with the handbook, and you also get review by the disciplinary review board consistent with the code of conduct.
So just so I
didn't cite that in our
just so I get what your allegation is, then you're really alleging on the breach of contract issue that the breach was essentially the same as your due process claim, which is that your client didn't get the process that was due. On the one hand, you say that it was a constitutional violation, and on the other, you're saying that it was a breach of a promise, but it's the same promise that you're saying is the basis for both claims?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Can I just take you aside for just before getting into those for a moment and looking at the other claim, which is your Section 1983 claim? Right. I noticed that the district court disposed of that claim based upon the Rendell Baker U.S. Supreme Court case. And the district court said that you ignored that case. And then in your appellant brief, unless I'm missing it, you didn't cite that case or argue any distinction of that case. I noticed that the respondent did argue that that case barred your claim under Section 1983. And I did not see a reply brief that addressed that case. If I missed it, is that case actually discussed in your brief?
I don't believe it is, Your Honor. And I know that respondent did address it in their brief, but we did not address it in our brief because we felt the Arborio and the Outsides case were good law. And that's why
right. Well, those are good law at the time, but you know that the Rendell Baker case came after that, and the Supreme Court of the United States kind of takes precedent when it comes to what is and what is not a state actor. So am I correct that you've waived? I understand that you've waived any argument about Rendell Baker. I was troubled by the fact that you didn't address it at all. I don't know what you're asking us to do, to infer that you're challenging the district court's analysis and then to infer what your argument is.
Well, we alleged in the brief that we cited all sides and about the state action. If the court determines, based on the case you just cited, that there was no state action by the school, then the strongest claim we have is the breach of contract. And I will concede that that's our position.
Thank you.
Yep.
So, counsel, on that point, just to clarify, so a couple questions. One, you don't cite any, can you cite to any Minnesota published case after Rendell Baker that a private school's conduct is a state action?
No, I don't. We couldn't find any cases on point that address that. No.
Okay, so and I read your brief to really just primarily rely on all sides, as sure. Judge Ross highlighted, came before the Rendell Baker case. So are you conceding that issue has been waived?
Not conceding it's been waived because we pled it. I just am basically saying that if this court finds that case determines the a due process claim in the 1983 claim, then our strongest claim is the breach of contract claim. I would cite to the court that we cited in the brief the decision of the Ramsey County District Court about that the appellant was a third party beneficiary to the educational contract. And in that case, the court did not dismiss the case and allowed it to go forward, and we attached it.
There are many brilliant judges in Ramsey County District Court, of course. In fact, some would say all of them. However, that decision is not precedential.
I understand.
So on what basis would we rely upon it?
Yeah, well, basically, you don't have to rely on it, but we cited it because just for the proposition that's what the district court ruled, and I wanted to indicate to you that, you know, the courts are looking at these claims in such a way that they are giving deference to the way the cases are pled. And again, as I'm arguing, and as the court has cited that case, if you decide,
can I ask one additional question about that?
Sure.
If we were to ask you, or if the district court were to direct you to make a more definite statement in your complaint as to what the specific promise is, or specific promise was that originated from the code of conduct, or the tuition contract, or the student handbook, would you be able to make a more specific statement about what exactly was specifically promised to your client that was not provided by the school?
And it's our position that the handbook, which laid out or described the appellant's rights, that was a breach as well. That handbook is part of the contract.
So what exactly in the handbook? Because I don't have the handbook, so I haven't been able to, I just don't know what it is. I'm asking you, is there something in the handbook that we don't know about that we should know about to be able to better understand your complaint?
The best I can do in that regard is cite you to the complaint, as I already have, paragraph 19 okay. and 20.
All right.
And the promises made by the administration, number one, he gets a due process hearing. Number two, that he then, depending on the outcomes, gets the matter reviewed by the disciplinary board of review.
Okay.
Those two pieces are in the handbook when I reviewed it.
So just so I'm clear,
that's why we put it the way we did.
Just so I'm perfectly clear on this, based upon what you've just described your allegations to be, if we were to determine in this appeal that your client has no due process claim, would you agree that your client also has no breach of contract claim?
I cannot agree with Your Honor. I think he's got a very good breach of contract claim, and the breach of contract is the breach of the handbook as well as the promises that were made. Our position is we can rely only on the promises that were made to have a breach of contract claim and a breach of his due process rights.
But counsel, to further to Judge Ross's question, which relates back to some questions he asked earlier, isn't the breach of contract claim based upon the lack of due process? In other words, isn't the breach of contract claim based on a promise to provide due process?
It's a combination of both, Your Honor. Number one, due process was violated. He wasn't given the hearing that he was promised. Secondly, he wasn't given the review that he was promised. They summarily, after March 2nd, said, we're not going to do either of the above. You're done. You're out of here. And gave him no fair due process right. The expulsion was arbitrary and capricious, is our position.
So what's the difference between the review and the hearing, or is that the same thing?
No, the hearing, the due process hearing would have allowed the appellant to testify, call witnesses in his defense, tell his story. As you know from the complaint, the police cleared him of any misconduct. And those
but whether the police did or not, the school can still hold its own review.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's the emphasis I'm putting on this is he was promised that, and that promise was breached. And that's part of the contract. Our position is.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Anything else from the panel? All right, counsel, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. All right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Just one moment while all right. Mr. Nelson, go ahead, sir.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Sam Nelson, attorney at Meyer, Kennedy & Quinn, appearing on behalf of Pelley's De La Salle High School, Barry Leeske, and Jim Benson. As already discussed by appellant's counsel, we have three claims. Violation of Section 1983 due process, violation of common law due process, and breach of contract. We're asking today that this court uphold the district court's decision dismissing all three claims. First, regarding Section 1983, as mentioned by Your Honors, the controlling authority on Section 1983 is the U.S. Supreme Court case Rendell Baker v. Cohn in 1982, which provides that a private school is not considered a state actor. In that case, 90% of the school's funding came from government sources. Nearly every student enrolled at that school was referred to the school by state agencies. Even that level of involvement did not make the private school a state actor.
Counsel, is there something in the student handbook that provides for a disciplinary process prior to the expulsion of a student?
Your Honor, the student handbook is not a part of the record.
I get it. I understand that. I'm asking.
I would have to check. This argument that the student handbook is the basis for a contract is a new one. It wasn't raised at the district court.
Well, it was raised in the complaint, wasn't it? This is the part that troubles me about the district court's decision, and you can address it. The district court said, is on page 6 of the district court's order, and I'm quoting here, there is nothing in the complaint that alleges express terms of a contract or references a school handbook or other material that could be interpreted as a promise. Now, the problem I have with that is this is our standard of review and the standard for Rule 12. The district court is supposed to draw all inferences in favor of the plaintiff. So it looks like here the district court inferred, even though the complaint says that there is some promise that was made, that was breached, and the promise being in the code of conduct and the student handbook or policies or someplace in the school's documents. The complaint alleges that that's the source of the promise. And the district court seems to say here that we don't see anything in the complaint that specifies where that promise is made. And so my question for you is, didn't the district court draw an inference against the plaintiff's complaint in making that conclusion? And if so, how is that permissible under Rule 12?
Well, it's correct that factual allegations in the complaint must be assumed to be true. Legal conclusions in the complaint do not need to be assumed to be true.
Well, the complaint says that there's a promise that was, or contract or promise somewhere in the policies and the code of conduct. And if there is such a promise, let's say there is a specific promise in the code of conduct or in the policies, shouldn't we infer that, in fact, that sort of specific promise exists under Rule 12?
Well, the case law regarding specific promises doesn't allow pleading just a vague overall promise of educational experience or the experiences that go along with high school. A plaintiff has to identify a specific contractual promise. So simply stating
you mean has to identify it at summary judgment stage or at the pleading stage, because that's where we are. Is there case law that makes that point at the pleading stage?
Yes, Your Honor. We cite to Martins v. Minnesota Mining and Manufacturing, Minnesota case from 2008. And that was a Rule 12.02E motion to dismiss. And there the court said that complaint must identify a specific contractual promise.
So let's take this a different way. So counsel indicates that paragraph 19 and 20 of the complaint set forth promises that there's going to be some sort of a due process hearing or an investigation or something that is going to happen before the expulsion of the student. And that those promises parrot the promises that are in the student handbook. Is that true? I mean, this is your client, so I'm asking you, is that true? Is that in the student handbook?
Your Honor, as I mentioned, it's not a part of the record. The student handbook is hasn't been cited and isn't a part of the record. So we don't have on the record what's in the student handbook.
Is the student handbook referenced in the complaint?
It is not.
So it's just the, okay.
I don't believe it is.
Maybe I'm misrecalling the complaint then. Is it just the policies of the school and the code of conduct that are referenced?
I'm not even certain that the code of conduct is specifically referenced. It just says the LS violated school policies.
So then let's ask it a different way. Are there any school policies vaguely referenced by the complaint that provide for some sort of a process before a student is expelled from the high school?
Your Honor, I would have to review all of the policies of the school. It's that the plaintiff hasn't pled any specific promise made by the school.
Okay. Let me ask you the question in a different way, Mr. Nelson. Looking specifically at complaint paragraphs 19 and 20, let's put aside the student handbook. I don't recall and I cannot find any reference to the student handbook. And so let's assume for the sake of argument, it's not part of the complaint, it's not even an inference that we can make. But the complaint does state in paragraphs 19 that Lemon, who is representative of the school district, says that, quote, Lemon went on to further indicate that the next step would be that BT would participate in a due process hearing, which would consist of Lemon and others. And then paragraph 20 says that it was explained to Ms. Trina Paul and BT that after that hearing, a recommendation would then be made by the, all caps now, Disciplinary Board of Review, which sounds like a formal board to administration regarding the matter. Those two paragraphs, when we are looking at it from the Rule 12 perspective and looking at those notice pleadings in light most favorable to appellant, why is that not enough of a due process that hearing or set of hearings that promises that were made to appellant? Why isn't that enough right there?
Well, I guess first, Your Honor, the individuals involved in these allegedly making these statements are deans of the school. I don't think there's an allegation that these are officers of the school able to form unilateral contracts. I don't see any basis, and appellant hasn't argued that a unilateral contract has been formed by statements made by the deans of the school.
Let me press a little bit more as you continue to answer Judge Reyes's question further, if you have more to say about it. Would we or would we not infer from the complaint that the deans are making this representation of a hearing consistent with a policy or procedure of the school?
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe that was pled.
Right, but we're drawing inferences in favor of the complaint now. So I'm wondering whether the complaint alleges there are policies that were breached, and specifically the complaint alleges that the deans made specific promises. So shouldn't we infer that the policies that are allegedly breached, which we don't have, after all, it's notice pleading, we don't have the actual policies, but we do have the representation. Should we not infer that the policies that are embodied in the promise, the oral promise, is consistent with the policies of the school for the purposes of Rule 12? And if not, explain, please, why not?
Your Honor, I think this entire line of reasoning that's being proposed by appellant for the first time today really highlights the amorphous pleadings of the breach of educational contract. If we look at the claim itself, paragraph 56 is where the appellant actually states the breach of contract. And he says that DLS breached its educational contract by failing to provide to the plaintiff that education and the educational experience after it failed to follow processes.
Right. And so part of the complaint about breach is failure to follow the processes that the complaint, even though it may not be perfectly stated, does say was embodied in this promise. And then we have the policy reference in the complaint. So if you could address that question at the same time, and don't lose sight of, if you had more to say specifically about Judge Reyes's question, I didn't mean to rephrase his question, but I would like you to get at these issues. Again, from a Rule 12 perspective.
All right. So the issue is that there is not a specific policy cited. The court can't infer that somewhere out there, there's some policy that might provide a basis for these promises. The plaintiff has to specifically identify a promise.
I think he's saying that he did identify a promise and what was articulated, and that promise would then have to be consistent with the policy in order to make a claim. I'm just wondering if for the purposes of Rule 12, I get your, it sounds like you're making a summary judgment argument. I'm trying to focus us back on Rule 12 and the inferences. You're saying that we can't draw any inferences. Why wouldn't that be a reasonable inference that the policy says what these deans said?
Based on the Martins v. Minnesota Mining and Manufacturing, a plaintiff has to identify a specific contractual promise. In that case, the plaintiff had cited to a general policy by Minnesota Mining and Manufacturing that employees could go up a pay scale and follow certain progression of promotion. That policy itself, though, was not specific, stated that it wouldn't apply the same way to every employee. And for those reasons, the court said that's not a specific contractual promise and it doesn't meet Minnesota's notice pleading requirement.
Well, let me ask you this. Okay. If the complaint said that the policies of the school expressly say that a student is entitled to a hearing under circumstances like this, is that a specific enough promise that can form a breach of contract claim if the promise is not met?
Potentially. That would require a different analysis than what we have here because that wasn't
no, but my question alleged is, in this case. I understand that you're saying it wasn't alleged. I'm asking you, would that be a specific enough promise had it been alleged?
If it were alleged that there were steps A, B, and C in the process and that it would apply to every student, no matter the situation, then potentially yes.
Well, in this case, we have a representation by a couple of deans, according to the complaint. And I don't think that representation exists in the cases that you're citing. The cases that you're citing just refer to contracts and policies, but here we have an actual oral representation. Am I correct that the case that you're relying on predominantly does not include this extra element of an oral promise?
Minnesota Mining and Manufacturing, I think, may not include an oral statement. The cases, a number of the cases, they'll look at the various promises and pull together all of the different statements that were made and alleged to and find that there's nothing specific identified.
Mr. Nelson, I want to go back. You had mentioned paragraph 56 of the complaint, and there it talks about, as you mentioned, education and educational experience. But then it says it failed to provide that by failing to follow appropriate investigative, procedural, and due process measures in its dealings with the plaintiff. That doesn't cite specifically to a school handbook, but as we mentioned already, the prior paragraphs of 19 and 20 do refer to a due process hearing and procedure that the deans represented would occur. Why isn't that oral promise, because it can rely on an oral promise, why isn't that enough of an oral promise that is alleged as well in count one and count two of the complaint, specifically paragraph 56?
I think again here, so first, those statements by the deans aren't identified in the claim itself.
But the claim does refer to appropriate investigative, procedural, and due process measures. And paragraphs 19 and 20 talk specifically about a due process hearing. Why isn't that enough when we've got notice pleading to support and we need to make all reasonable inferences in favor of appellant? Why isn't paragraph 19 paragraphs 19 and 20 enough to support paragraph 56 there?
Well, what appellees are arguing is that there is no specific promise that's been made, that's been identified, and a general statement by a dean doesn't meet that requirement.
Why not? Why doesn't a statement by a dean? Why shouldn't we, let's put it this way, why shouldn't we infer that the dean has authority and knowledge to provide an oral contract there, an oral promise?
There's no statement that the dean is an officer of the school in a position to make an oral contract, unilateral contract for the school. There's just a general reference to school policies. There's a reference to the tuition contract. There's no reference to the handbook. really the notice pleading requirements are that a specific specific contractual promise be identified. And in this case, the allegations from the appellant could really fit just about any circumstance, any situation at a high school. There's nothing specific involved here.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Anything else from the panel? All right, thank you, counsel. Counsel, rebuttal? Make sure you turn off your mute button, okay? Go ahead.
There we go. Thank you, Your Honor. At the outset, I want to say the promises made to the appellant were specific, very clear. That's why we cited them at paragraph 19 and 20.
So let me focus on paragraphs 19 and 20, right, which I understand are promises that originated from school administrators after the threat was made. Okay?
Correct. Correct.
How are those promises contractually binding? What is the consideration for those promises? I mean, I understand the tuition agreement perhaps forming the basis of a contract or a student handbook when the student enrolls, but what's the binding piece that makes the promises that occur after the threat, alleged threat is made, what makes those binding?
I believe we pled in the complaint, I can't cite the paragraph, that the promises that were made by the administrators were part of the educational process, that he was entitled to these hearings as part of their policies and as part of the educational process.
Well, that's a couple of different things I think you're answering there. I think Judge Frisch is getting at if the promises, let me rephrase her question a little bit differently. Would you agree that if the promises that were made by the deans were not part of the policy, that they were standalone promises after the fact, that there is no consideration for those promises, and in order to have a breach of contract claim, therefore, based upon those promises, that the promises have to embody what is elsewhere in the policies or code of conduct or other references you've made in your complaint. Do you agree with that?
Not necessarily. I think the way we pled it is sufficient.
I understand that. I'm just asking from a theoretical standpoint of just a basis in law that in order to have a breach of contract claim, you have to have a contract, which requires an offer, acceptance, and consideration. We all remember that. We might have forgotten everything else about law school, but we all definitely remember that.
So, I remember clearly.
So if the promise was made of a hearing and there was no detrimental reliance, there was no behavior by your client afterwards that demonstrated any extra consideration for it, that itself cannot form the basis of a breach of contract claim unless those promises are embodied in a policy that predates the promise.
And I believe they are. We didn't include them in the record, but I have seen them. And I didn't think in drafting the complaint we needed to plead them, because we pled paragraphs 19 and 20, which were more specific to this case. And our position at that time when we drafted the complaint is paragraphs 19 and 20 were sufficient, they were specific and binding on the respondent.
So when I look at paragraph 46 of the complaint, it says DLS specifically promised, here's your specifically promised educational services and associated extracurricular activities that are inferred and stated from DLS policies and code of conduct. Now, when I think about educational services, I think about I'm going to offer math class and I'm going to have tutoring services and I'm going to have counseling services, traditional education services. A due process is something different than an educational service or an extracurricular activity.
I think it's part of it, Your Honor. I think to treat the appellant in an arbitrary, unfair, biased way that the upper administration did is part of the educational process. I think when a student like the appellant signs, his parents sign the contract, they pay the tuition, he does the classes for a year and a half and does well, And then all of a sudden this thing comes up, proved to be false, and they still acted in an arbitrary, capricious manner, even though two administrators promised a hearing, at least one hearing and possibly two. I think it's all part of the educational process that he and his family are entitled to.
I have a question for you on the contract, on the breach of contract. For you have Lemon and Gilland here who are both, they're both deans of students, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
Is there anything in your complaint to identify the fact that they are officers of the school that can bind the school to a promise? And I'm going back to, well, let's just stop right there.
I think anytime school officials and dean of students are school officials, and they were sent to the home on March 2nd to confer with my client's parents, specifically his mother, and made the representations that they made to her from a position of authority, which clearly that's the position they were there for, that that's sufficient.
But
and we
but,
put it that way, and if we take the position, it was sufficient.
But that's not the point. You could have investigators go out from the school, and if the school investigators who are, you could have a third party investigator hired by the school to go out and say, okay, we're doing an investigation here, and here are the next steps. They can't bind the school. In order to bind the school, in order to bind an entity, you have to have people in authority to bind that entity, including a school. So what I'm looking for is some indication that they had the authority to bind the school, even if with this oral promise, and I don't see any. Is there anything in the complaint to indicate that they actually had the authority to bind the school to any oral promise made?
Well, that's why they were there. They were there to resolve this matter, tell him his rights, and proceed accordingly. They even said to him, we hope you're back to school in a couple days. And then it was
That's immaterial though, counsel. Is there anything to show that they actually had the authority to bind the school to any promises that they made?
I don't think we put it that way, but I would take the position that because they're school administrators, that the actions they took are binding. And that was all reversed on March 3rd when the president of the school said, you're out of here, no hearings, end of story. And therein lies the violation.
All right, anything else from the panel today? Council, thank you very much. I really appreciate your flexibility, your willingness to participate in this virtual world. Hope you are all safe and well. This matter was well briefed and argued. We'll take the matter under advisement today and issue an order, an opinion within the statutory time frame. All right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
With
thank
this
you,
matter, the Court of Appeals is adjourned this morning. Thank you.
Thank you.